All right, everybody, welcome back to the Invisible College. I'm your host, John Pistelli. You have been listening to the perhaps unnerving sounds of Friedrich Nietzsche's musical composition, The Manfred Meditation of 1872, his musical interpretation of Lord Byron's dramatic poem, Manfred. I don't know if that was soothing or I described Chopin last week as soothing. I feel like Nietzsche's music should be unsoothing, but I don't know anything about music. I don't know how I would characterize it. I remember I watched a mediocre horror movie. It was like direct to Amazon a few years ago. Sydney Sweeney was in it before she got super famous, and it was set in a conservatory, and I don't even remember the plot, but it was a horror movie. It was kind of Black Swan, but music instead of ballet. It was mediocre. It wasn't bad. It's on Amazon. But they kept talking about the devil's chord, the devil's tritone. And I don't know anything about music, so I don't know about that. But I imagine a composition by Nietzsche would involve the devil's chord. But anyway, I think it sounds actually rather nice, except for the somewhat jarring piano there. Nietzsche, Byron, Manfred, welcome back to the Invisible College. Again, I'm your host, John Pistelli. You can find everything for your Invisible College needs and other needs related to me at granthotelibus.substack.com. This will be an episode on Lord Byron. I have a couple of different goals for this episode vis-a-vis prior ones. First, I think I'm going to try to keep it shorter than the others. Each episode has been longer than the previous so far, until we were almost up to 3 hours with Keats, and I think that can be good, but the fact is I don't have that much to say about Lord Byron. I am an amateur of Lord Byron. I'm a babe in the Lord Byron woods, so I more want to use the topic of Lord Byron as an occasion to take stock. Where have we been? And where are we going? So I'm going to keep it a little shorter and not dwell so much on the text itself, even though I sometimes make fun of the cultural studies people. I probably am more interested in Byron as a cultural phenomenon than as a writer so far, though I've read more Lord Byron and read more about Lord Byron preparing for this than I think I ever have before in my life. So you will never encounter me knowing more about Lord Byron than you will now, except perhaps in the future. This is like a temporal paradox. So anyway, keep it short. That's my first goal. So I've deliberately prepared a slideshow that's half the length of the prior slideshows. Those were all 15 slides. This one will be 8, slightly more than half. You can't do half of 15 unless you have a fraction. If you want that slideshow, that will be available at, once again, granthotelibus.substack.com. Second of all, I do plan on giving this one away for free. I think you need to do that every so often as a business strategy. I did read a Substack post about once, months ago, about how to do a podcast successfully with a paywall. And they were saying that you should do the Red Scare strategy, which is half the episode should be paywalled and half the episode should be free. That seems like a lot to give away for free. I mean, once you get to the Red Scare level, you might as well give them all away for free. But then on the other hand, this isn't the other hand. This is even more to the extreme. A podcast we I think are fans of around here, Art of Darkness, they give the main episodes away, and then they have they have other episodes where they're generally shorter and they dwell on sort of hotter topics, and they're a little looser about, you know, their opinions on politics or things, and that's behind a paywall. I'm sort of at the other extreme from them, if we put Red Scare in the middle, where I'm putting most behind a paywall, but I do want to give one away for free every so often, so you see what you're getting. So more people can be enticed to come on and join us in the Invisible College. So this will be a free episode. It will perhaps contain fewer fewer of my digressions that aren't fit for polite company that we'll see. I might just completely lose control of myself. But there will be, some of it. We'll talk about some of the things we've been talking about. This is a stock-taking episode. So welcome to one and all. Welcome to the entire internet. I imagine the entire internet will be listening to this free episode. And then among the reasons I'm doing this is because we're changing gears in several different ways next week, which is we're moving to a novel, which is Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice, which, while it belongs historically to the Romantic era, in certain ways looks forward to the Victorian era and is a change in literary form, genre, mode, whatever you want to call that, being novel rather than poetry. And I'll be covering the whole novel in one episode, which might be too ambitious, but in any case, I imagine that will be closer to the length of the Keats episode, just to get in the whole novel. So that's another reason I am kind of using this week as a pause, as a looking back, looking forward, summing up, using Lord Byron as the occasion to do so. So that is a summary of what we're going to do. And now let's do it. So I have my slideshow, my patented slideshow. I have one on Lord Byron. It's 8 slides long. It is called The Lightning of My Being, which is a line from Manfred. Nietzsche, of course, loved Manfred. And I'll talk a little bit about that as we go on. Really, I want to talk a lot about the Byronic hero and what that means for culture. So, the lightning of my being, and you'll recall in Zarathustra, Thus Spoke Zarathustra, Zarathustra, Nietzsche's sort of philosophical novel about the preacher Zarathustra, he says, "Behold the Übermensch. I teach you this lightning. I teach you this madness." A quote I myself first encountered when I was 13 in Alan Moore's Miracle Man, but I did later go on to read Thus Spoke Zarathustra. So I just thought that was an interesting connection. The lightning of my being, the lightning of the Übermensch, something we want to be thinking about. So that's the title of this lecture. And the painting, I have a painting. I have 3 different paintings, but of course I've forgotten the names of the painters, but they're all portraits of Lord Byron. This one is a very brooding, romantic portrait. He's got his chin on his hand, and he's looking forward, his head emerging from darkness, looking forward with piercing eyes. I think that might be my favorite portrait of Byron. And then in the 2 biographical slides, I have 2 other famous portraits of him. One of him in Albanian dress, which illustrates his cosmopolitanism and is also, you often find that if there are articles about Orientalism in British literature, it'll often be illustrated with Byron in Albanian dress. I don't know to what extent, well, I was going to say, I don't know what extent Albania. Sorry, there's a siren approaching. They're coming to arrest me for Orientalism. I don't know to what extent Albania is the Orient, but I think from the point of view of England, Albania was the Orient in the same way that it sometimes seems from the point of view of English literature that that Italy is the Orient or Russia is the Orient or things like this. So that's another thing, the portrait of Byron in Albanian dress, and then I have a famous painting of Byron on his deathbed. And so we'll talk about his life. I'm not going to go on and on about his life. I did not read, even less have I read in the door-stopping biographies of Byron than anyone else, even though he probably had the most dramatic life, even more dramatic than the Shelleys, with whose lives his life intersected. So I'm just going to give you a fairly quick rundown of his life. I'm kind of more interested in his image. What this suggests about the image, because the Byronic hero, as an archetype, as we'll see in a moment, refers both to heroes he wrote, characters he wrote in his poems, and himself. He was the Byronic hero. So I want to think about himself as a figure. We're at the very beginnings of celebrity culture here. Celebrity culture will require things like something like a mass media, and we're just at the very beginnings of having something like that at this moment. Remember Wordsworth in the preface to Lyrical Ballads written in 1800, complaining about how London is just deluged in news and information and popular culture. And to us, that looks like quite quaint, but I think there was a novelty to all of that at the time. And Byron is often cited as one of the first sort of celebrities in the modern sense, sort of with a self-perpetuating and self-sustaining fame, even in excess of his actual work or what he did. Though certainly, a lot of celebrities in the modern sense don't write 900-page epic poems the way he did, so it wouldn't be quite fair to compare him to, whomever. He's closer to somebody who is actually artistically productive, like not a Taylor Swift, she's too wholesome, but like a Lana Del Rey or something like that, or Paglia compares him to Elvis, because there is a body of artistic production, including the artistic production of this image. So it's not just famous for being famous, but the fame becomes self-perpetuating and self-sustaining and attaches as much to the legend of the biography of the person and the scandals around the person as to whatever work is coming out for that individual. So who is George Gordon Lord Byron? He was born in 1788 in London. So we're sort of dropping back. He was born before Keats and Shelley. He was older than them and outlived them, though not by much, as you'll see. So he's born 1788 in London, like Shelley, to an aristocratic family. So he's coming out of an aristocratic lineage, and he gets the Lord title fairly early too, once some relative died. Not, I don't think his father, some other relative died, and then he inherited that person's kind of lordship over a certain estate or a certain territory. So he gets the Lord title pretty early, and he eventually also serves in the Parliament, but I think fairly briefly. So he has kind of a political career to go with his poetic and other careers. He was, in America, we'd say privately educated, they would say publicly educated. So he attends Harrow, which is one of the big English public schools, from 1801 to 1805, and then Cambridge from 1805 to 1808, though he is not expelled the way Shelley is. Was that Cambridge or Oxford? I don't remember, but he wasn't expelled for writing The Necessity of Atheism, though he would go on to be even more scandalous than Shelley. He does begin writing poetry. Around this time, around his college years, he publishes a collection called, I love the title, Hours of Idleness in 1807. And then when it receives bad reviews, his next book is a collection of satirical poems chastising these critics called English Bards and Scotch Reviewers. I guess his reviewers were Scottish, just 2 years later in 1809. And so he begins his poetic career when he's fairly young. Let's see, I can't do math, but he publishes his first book before he's even 20. So he gets started early. And then he travels in Europe for a few years, from 1809 to 1811. He visits Greece, Turkey, Italy. He's on the kind of grand tour where elite sons of the elite of England would go, and they would go see all the cultural sites of the continent. And this was a kind of a practice that they had at the time of the Grand Tour. So he goes on that for a few years. And then he comes back and he publishes in 1812 the poem that makes him famous, or parts of the poem that make him famous. I think he published many of his poems kind of serially. Like Canto One would come out 1 year, Canto Two the next year, etc. So this is called Childe Harold's Pilgrimage. Child being in the sense of it's a medievalism. Remember, we're in that medievalizing romantic period. So child, by or Browning, we'll use it later for Childe Roland. It meant like a knight, like a wandering knight. So Childe Harold's Pilgrimage, and it's a kind of, and it starts out, it's kind of written in a imitation of Spenser's work from the Renaissance, and it begins with this archaic Spenserian medieval language, and then it gradually settles into a more plainer English as he narrates the wanderings, the pilgrimage of this somewhat autobiographical character, Childe Harold. And sometimes writing very directly about his marriage, the failure of his marriage, etc. And this makes him a celebrity overnight. He famously said he woke up to find himself famous. I used famous twice there. But it's because he found himself famous that that statement was famous. So this poem, which I've only read excerpts, to be candid with you, but this is the poem that makes him a star. He also does become famed for his various scandalous relations with for his love life, both things that are documented and then things that are known to a small circle and that are rumored. So for one thing, he was bisexual. He was having relations with men or boys, I think, might in the strict sense be pederasty when he was traveling in the on the continent, when he was traveling in places like Greece and Turkey. So that's one thing, and I think that was somewhat known. Also, he had an affair with Lady Caroline Lamb, who would later go on to be the wife of one of the prime ministers of England. He meets a half-sister he hadn't known for most of his life. He meets her when I think they're in their late teens or early 20s, and I think it's Sorry, someone's beeping the horn, the incest horn. I think that it's pretty well understood that he did have an affair with her, Augusta Lee. So he's famed for his various, what we might, I don't mean to make a moral equation, but what from their point of view we would consider non-normative sexual behaviors, bisexuality and incest. Again, I'm not equating those, but I think in the time, those things might have been equated. And then he has a disastrous marriage to Elizabeth, or not Elizabeth, Isabella, sorry, Milbank. He marries her in 1815, but the marriage only lasts a year. I think she discovered things about his relationship with Augusta. They did have a daughter, Ada Lovelace, who would later become famous for having some founding ideas about computer science. I don't know anything about that. And Isabella, in fact, was a kind of mathematician. And he called her my princess of parallelograms because she was a mathematician. So he has this disastrous marriage that only lasts a year. They separate. I don't think they ever divorced, but they were separated for pretty much the rest of his life. You already know he has the affair with Claire Claremont, the stepsister of Mary Shelley, which produced that daughter Allegra, who he essentially took from Claire and put into a convent where she died of typhus at the age of 5 or 6, a disastrous affair for Claire Claremont. And then later in life, he had an affair with Teresa, the Countess Guiccioli. Guiccioli. They're going to take away my Italian card. And I think she was married, but again, they do things differently on the continent, as Byron will write about in his epic poem, Don Juan. So he has an affair with her, and I think it's that too that draws him more deeply into European politics. That brings us, as I said, I'm not going to dwell on his life for a very long time. That brings us to his death. He did die young. He got 10 more years than Keats and 5 more, 6 more than Shelley, but still young. He dies at the age of 36 because he supports the Greek War of Independence. So if you recall what I was saying last week when I was discussing why we associate Keats and Shelley, I was saying that one of the things we associate is their classicizing impulse, their interest in particularly the culture, the mythology, the aesthetics of ancient Greece. And I said there was a political dimension to that too, because they, actually now all three, Keats, Shelley, Byron, were liberals at the time. And those countries, and Italy, in fact, wasn't a country then, would have been the center of a certain post-Napoleonic War or post-French Revolution political ferment where they were having their national liberation movements. where there were these attempted Republican revolutions because these territories were controlled by the empires and the dynasties of Europe. The Austrian Empire is controlling much of Italy. The Bourbon monarchy is controlling parts of Italy. The Ottoman Empire is controlling Greece. And so these territories are having these liberal Republican revolutions. And Keats and Shelley and Byron, as liberals, would have supported those kind of ideologically. So that's a subtext. And I would say that's a subtext even of a fairly apolitical poet like Keats. I think there's a kind of a political subtext there to his interest in the classics, which I think he would have associated with a liberation movement. Byron wanted to put his put himself in the service of that revolution much more directly. So he begins training and, raising up a little army around himself to support the Greek War of Independence to go fight in Greece, but he dies of a fever in 1824 in Greece before that can happen. But he's still considered, and to this day in Greece, he's still considered like a hero of their national liberation. And you'll see, I've never been to Greece, but my understanding is you'll see statues of Byron there. So he dies in at least indirectly in support of the Greek War of Independence. So what other works is he known for? Well, he's known for Childe Harold's Pilgrimage, 1812, which I mentioned. He does a series of shorter narrative poems that are kind of adventure stories or romances, that are The Giaour, The Corsair, The Prisoner of Chillon. I've read some of these and some of these I haven't. I'm not going to confess to you which and which, but they're romances. They're kind of adventure stories. They help to set up the idea of the Byronic hero. They're also often exoticist. That is, they have, settings abroad. He's very much associated with a cosmopolitan spirit. And one thing about him is that not only was he a celebrity, and so very known and read in England in ways that many of the writers we've been talking about weren't in their brief lifetimes, like Keats and Shelley, or even Blake in his long lifetime, they didn't get an English readership. Byron was enormously influential and widely read abroad on the continent, and his influence extends into French literature and German literature and Russian literature in ways we can talk about more later. So he is our first kind of internationally famous English writer. Perhaps, I think it's not an exaggeration to maybe say more loved on the continent than in English, or maybe even today more read there than read here, where we tend to favor figures like Wordsworth or Keats. So he has this international reputation, and I think there's a class component to that. He was an aristocrat, and so he was more in touch with a kind of aristocratic morality and attitude toward things like love and marriage that resonated more in places like France or Italy, or places that were still kind of more dominated by those attitudes, as opposed to the English attitude we're really going to get next week with Jane Austen, which kind of sanctifies marriage in a way that it maybe is very, first of all, is very middle class, and is very not kind of what, is the high culture attitude in places like France or Italy. So he resonated with them culturally more, but also his work was often set in those places and had a kind of satirical wit and verve and lightness that maybe feels something more like French literature than English literature. English literature is, it's Milton, it's Wordsworth, it's ponderous, it's humorless, it's ponderous. I'm exaggerating, but with Byron you get, and that's the thing about him, is that he's both the arch romantic figure. He creates the great fictional archetype of romanticism, which is the Byronic hero. But he's anti-romantic as well. He harked back in English letters to Pope, to Swift, to the satirical tradition, to Sterne. He didn't like Wordsworth. He didn't like he did like Milton, but he certainly didn't like his fellow romantics. He didn't like Keats. He did like Shelley, but they didn't have much in common as poets. So he's an interesting figure that's kind of bifurcated between being the most romantic and the least romantic of the romantic poets. And the reason I asked you to read Manfred, his dramatic poem of 1817, is because I think of his longer works, this is the most romantic. This is where you get, it's almost a digest of themes we've seen so far in the other romantic poets. It feels almost like secondary literature, something like a list of characteristics of romanticism. And so Manfred is Byron, as the capital R romantic. But then his life's work, what's considered his great work, the epic poem Don Juan, which he works on up until his death, it's not finished. He works on it from 1819 to 1824. That is, it's a satirical, humorous, witty, picaresque, epic poem, but it's more like a novel, as I want to discuss. It's like a wandering, picaresque, 18th century, digressive, sort of bumptious, dirty novel. It feels more like Tristram Shandy, which was one of its inspirations, or more like Tom Jones or something like that than it does like any kind of an epic poem. More like Tom Jones or Tristram Shandy than like Paradise Lost or like the Divine Comedy. So, and it's even written in this heavily rhymed style. And I actually do want to look at some excerpts from Don Juan at the end of this lecture after I say some words about Manfred, because I think that it'll be interesting to see Byron in his anti-romantic mode. He sort of slips a little. We're very interested here in the Romantic Manifestos, and he kind of slips a little anti-romantic manifesto. Now, I haven't read the whole of Don Juan. It's very long and unfinished. I'm very bad at unfinished works. Like, I never finished reading Kafka's The Castle. It's like, well, he didn't finish it. Never read Edwin Drood, even though I love Dickens. I'm bad with unfinished works, but I did read. They give a really solid, like, digest of the first two cantos in the Norton anthology. And so I did read that. That was like a 50 or 60 page selection. So I feel like I have a pretty good grounding in what it's like and what it's about. But I didn't read the whole thing, I will confess to you. Maybe that's another reason to give this episode away. What are you paying for if I can't read all of Don Juan? But I've read more of it in the last week than I've ever read before in my life. And it is entertaining, and it moves very quickly. He said he wanted it to, he wrote it quickly, and he said he wanted it to read fast. It's not meant to be a ponderous epic poem in slow-moving blank verse. It's written in these very fast-moving rhymed stanzas that are full of jokes and that are very, and the story is kind of, I don't want to say shallow, but Byron is not the kind of poet we've been looking at so far. He's not like a Blake where there's a private mythology, and he's not like a Shelley where there seems to be some kind of infinite meaning. Or a Keats, where there's like an infinite meaning packed into each word that we can unfold. I think he thought poetry was to entertain, to amuse, and to enlighten, but not to be some kind of visionary effusion, or some religious testament, or some private myth. I think it was very different for him. And then that shows. I don't think it would actually be much of a problem to read all of Don Juan in something like a week or 2 weeks, despite how long it is, and it's being unfinished. I think it's that fast moving and that sort of entertaining. And someday I hope to do it. But for now, I'll content myself with these excerpts, and I'll share a few of the excerpts with you where he makes an aside on his poetic principles. So, I would say those are his major works: Childe Harold's Pilgrimage, Manfred, and Don Juan, and then a set of shorter romances, and then some very famous short poems: She Walks in Beauty Like the Night, or So We'll Go No More A-Roving So Late Into the Night. You always want to write about the night; it seems romantic. So he has some short poems that have passed into the English language. His posthumous reputation—I don't know this story as well. If we are, can we've been keeping up with T.S. Eliot as our as our kind of thermometer to modernist opinion. And T.S. Eliot didn't like him. T.S. Eliot said, he said, I can't think of any other major poet who added nothing to the language. And he said, many people speak English, but only a small handful write it, which is to say, have a transformative effect. So there's your sort of modernist, elitist vision of literature. And Byron wasn't one. There was no effect. And I think maybe there's a hint there of, because Byron was very influential on Poe, and what those two share is a great influence in Europe. And one of the things you often hear quips about Poe about, well, he reads better in translation. And then that was Harold Bloom's famous joke. I think I've told this before on a podcast, or maybe just to one of my classes. But Harold Bloom said, well, somebody should translate Poe into English. And I think that Byron, Eliot's maybe hinting at something there about Byron. It's written in this kind of shallow way. It reads well in a prose translation or something. And then the other thing before we get to T.S. Eliot is that, like Shelley, but to a greater degree, his reputation suffered a dip in the Victorian age once more was known about his scandalous life. And the Victorian age was a much more conservative cultural atmosphere than the Regency period in which he was writing, which was much more culturally freewheeling. And you can see there are conservative attacks on him right away, and on him and on Shelley and on Keats, and we've seen samples of that, and we'll see some samples of that today. And so his reputation kind of suffers a dip, and then I think it comes back up again with the it ra rises back up with the general re-emergence of the Romantic poets in the mid to late 20th century under the influence of critics like Bloom and Fry that we've been talking about. Even Jerome McGann, who I sort of slighted as the author of the Romantic ideology way back in our Wordsworth lecture, he has a book, or several books, in fact, on Byron, and is in fact a fan of Byron, and has kind of promoted his work. So I think Byron's reputation is quite solid now. So that is his life, his legacy, but his real influence, I think it's a little different from some of the influences we've seen. And if we just keep him with his generation, Keats and Shelley have this influence on the subsequent lineage of poetry. So Tennyson picks up Keats and Shelley, and Browning, and Yeats, and Wallace Stevens, and Elizabeth Bishop, and conveys it through English and American poetry up to the present. So they have this enormous influence on the poetic tradition that still extends even, I mentioned our late laureate Louise Glick, who always paid tribute to, talked about, I think she liked Keats and I think she liked Blake. And so it continues even to living poets today. That's Keats and Shelley. Their influence was on poetry. Byron's influence was more on the novel and on popular culture, and both, popular culture and or the novel. I mean, both, the high novel and the low novel, and then forms of popular media coming out of the novel in the 20th century. So his creation of the Byronic hero and his embodiment of the Byronic hero kind of brings this new archetype into narrative and dramatic literature. And you see it immediately in the heroes of the Bronte sisters in Heathcliff and in Rochester, and you see it in Captain Ahab, and you see it in, for instance, the founding Russian novel, which is a novel in verse, kind of inspired, I think, by Byron. The Evgeny Onyegin of Pushkin has this kind of Byronic, hero. So he's having this germinative effect on non-English literatures, and then out of Pushkin comes Tolstoy and Dostoevsky. Both of them will sort of play certain changes on the Byronic hero. And then who else did I mention? Captain Ahab. And then on popular sort of novels, first of all, arguably, Mary Shelley knew Byron. So first of all, there's Victor Frankenstein, might be one of the first Byronic heroes in fiction. And then at the end of the 19th century, it sort of, influences figures as diverse as Dracula and Dr. Jekyll and Sherlock Holmes in certain ways. And then that gets you into pulp literature, and then that gets you into Batman. And so the Byronic hero is completely still with us in popular culture. Now, he didn't invent this figure out of whole cloth. He's drawing on a series of precursors himself, but he kind of puts it together into one image that gets passed down. And so his influence today, if you were to seek for Keats and Shelley's influence today, you'd probably be looking at serious poets. If you were to seek for Lord Byron's influence today, you'd probably be actually want to look more in the realm of popular culture, with that figure of the Byronic hero. So that is Byron's life and legacy. But let's look in a little more detail at how that works out. And then I want to end this lecture with a general reflection on a question I asked, I think, last week, which is why did none of these six romantic poets, well, this is too much of a generalization, why didn't they quite write their epics? They all wanted to write an epic, they all tried to write an epic. Blake and Wordsworth sort of succeeded, but they succeeded in a way that was itself kind of a telling failure. Byron, too, succeeds in a way that's sort of a telling failure. Shelley and Keats never quite got it together. Coleridge never got it together. So, what is, I think this is not just a personal matter. I think there's some kind of cultural logic. God, I sound like Frederick Jameson, but there's some kind of I hesitate because I like to privilege the individual imagination, but sometimes I do think we have to take account of larger scale forces happening through the society and the culture that in turn have some transformative impact on literature. And so I want to think about why, almost every single one of these guys worships Milton, and they couldn't write a Paradise Lost. There is no Paradise Lost of the Romantic period. That is, there's no epic poem we all still read and know, or even if we don't read it, we know something about it. Even people that don't read Paradise Lost, they're like, oh, that's the thing where Satan's the real hero, which is oversimplified, but they know a bit of trivia about it. There's not really anything like that. There's not that kind of an epic in the Romantic period. And I think thinking about that through the lens of Byron, and then as we're going to move on to the novel next week, will be an interesting speculation. So that's where I want to end. Like I said, I'm going to keep it short. I've already been talking for almost 40 minutes, so I don't know how short it's going to be. But I do only have five more slides. I only have three slides for Manfred because I don't think it's that. I don't think it's a work that requires a vast explication, especially if you've been following along with what we've been doing here in the Invisible College. I think, like I said, it's kind of a digest of themes we've already encountered. So, what is Manfred? What is a dramatic poem? And that's important because another thing that is happening at this point in for the Romantic poets is none of them really writes a successful play either. And Wordsworth, we saw Wordsworth in the preface to the Lyrical Ballad saying the stage is crowded with these stupid German tragedies. And we saw references to Joanna Baillie, who is writing these Gothic plays. The way I've heard it explained, and this is very clear, I think, in Manfred, is that the Romantics move drama inside. Everything is happening in the heads of the characters. It's an inward art. It's a lyric, as Polya says, they turn everything into lyric, which is a personal, inward, interior art. So they move any action that would be happening on a stage psychologically into the interior. And so it just becomes like a visionary psychodrama. that you couldn't stage because it is so visionary, which is true of perhaps the best play, quote unquote, play of the Romantics, which is Shelley's Prometheus Unbound, which you couldn't stage, really. I mean, maybe you could now, but back then it would have required some sort of extraordinary special effects because it's set in these sublime mountains. But so is Manfred, and Manfred was not written to be staged. When he calls it a dramatic poem, one of the things he means is it's a drama in the form of a poem. You're just supposed to read it. There's no expectation that it will be staged. And then, we see in Keats, who probably had, in some ways, the most dramatic sensibility, loved Shakespeare. He's the only one who loved Shakespeare more than Milton. Even Byron has a letter. He wrote millions of letters. Millions is an exaggeration, but thousands of letters. And I only read the ones in the Norton Anthology. But he has one where he says, "Oh, Shakespeare, I would demote Shakespeare. He's not dramatic, and he stole all his plots." And, Milton is the one. Even Byron said Milton is the one who wrote the sublime poetry. So I think Keats is the only one that loves Shakespeare more than Milton. But his dramatic genius comes out in the odes, which are these kind of dramatic utterances, these like Hamlet-like Shakespearean monologues in the form of lyric poetry. So they couldn't write a proper play in the same way they couldn't write a proper epic. And it's not, I think, merely personal to each of them. I don't think it's merely a failure on their part. I think it bespeaks a larger cultural logic, part of which was the idea of the fragment, which we looked at in our lecture on Coleridge, that romantic idea that every work of art was inherently incomplete because it was simply part, an expression of part of the ever ongoingness and unfoldingness of the universe. It was more appropriate that it be unfinished, that it does break off in the middle. That's part of it, but I think there's something else happening. So we'll talk about that. But Manfred is a dramatic poem. You couldn't really stage it. What is it about? It's about. So let's digress for 1 minute. I haven't even started talking about the subject, and I'm already digressing from it. But one of the things often said about it's often compared to Goethe's Faust. So Goethe's Faust, perhaps the single greatest work of literature of the Romantic era, if you take all of Europe, Goethe's Faust, especially part one. It's in two parts. He too, like as with Don Juan and Byron, Goethe worked on Faust all his life, from his 20s to his 80s. And part one of Goethe's Faust is a play of reasonable length that you could imagine staging, that you could pick up tonight, today, whenever you're listening to this. You could pick it up after you listen to this lecture and read it in 2, 3 hours. It's a normal play. And then part two is this long, kind of epic, visionary, phantasmagorical extravaganza that has been really compared to Ulysses as a kind of forerunner to Ulysses. And some of what Joyce does in Ulysses is, I think, clearly inspired by Faust Part Two. But Part One is a more normal play, and there's a pre-existing Faust myth going back to the Middle Ages in Northern Europe. The kind of ultimate source is this like pamphlet slash chapbook of the Middle Ages, the Faust book, which tells the story. And then Christopher Marlowe has the famous play, Dr. Faustus, which is, it's on one hand, it's a very famous play. It's the only play not written by Shakespeare from the English Renaissance that we all still read. But both Goethe and Byron claim they didn't read it, which is interesting. I don't know what maybe. Maybe Marlowe's reputation was at a low ebb at that point. And Marlowe is kind of a Byronic figure in the Renaissance in his own right. But they both said they didn't read it. Goethe was working directly from the legend. And so was Marlowe. So that's what accounts for similarities you'll see between Marlowe's Dr. Faustus in the 1590s and Goethe's Faust Part One, roughly at the end of the 18th century. The basic story, though, which you probably know, is about an intellectual, a scholar, in some incipient way, a scientist, but somebody seeking ultimate knowledge who is despairing of ever holding this knowledge, despairs that he's a worm and not a god, and ends up bargaining with this demon, Mephistopheles, He says, I'll trade you my soul, and you can collect my soul in some, differs from version to version, but some length of time, 30 years, I think it usually is, if you give me this knowledge and this power. And one way to read it is as a warning against magic and against trafficking with these spirits. And in Marlowe's play, the kind of joke of the play is that he does a bunch of, that's a motorcycle, is that he does a bunch of ridiculous and stupid and unworthy things with these powers. He sort of plays practical jokes on the Pope and things like this. And there's some of that in Goethe's version, but Goethe, first of all, deepens the tragedy by having Faust have an affair with Margareta, this bourgeois woman, and she has a baby out of wedlock, and then I think she is going to be like cast out of the community. So I think she kills the baby and then dies. And then this is a spoiler, but the trick of Act One is it ends with her soul being saved despite her sins. And then the trick of Act Two, I'm going to spoil the whole of Goethe's Faust for you. It's so good. But it's not something you'd read for the plot. That would be insane. The thing of Part Two is it ends with Faust's soul being saved, despite all the evil he did. Now, in Marlowe, his soul is taken to hell, but in Goethe, he's saved, and the God fig, God in Goethe's drama says, and this is kind of like a credo of modernity, he says, all who strive will be saved. So it's not about morality anymore. This is kind of an arch romantic statement. As long as you move this ever unfolding abundance of this thing of nature and the universe forward, then it's not about morality anymore. Remember Blake, energy is eternal delight. Energy is hell. Energy is eternal delight. Exuberance is beauty. All these Blakean mottos. We're not in the world of medieval Christianity anymore, and it's not about morality anymore. All who strive will be saved. And that's kind of the moral of Goethe's Faust, which is wonderful, by the way. It's probably one of the most neglected classics now. It used to be, in the American romantics like Emerson and Melville, and then the Victorians like Carlyle and George Eliot were just steeped in Goethe. They understood that Goethe was like the major writer of the late 18th, early 19th century. And for some reason, he's just disappeared. Even though there's many good translations available, some are very readable. So Goethe's Faust is a book I recommend. There is, if you're kind of intimidated by the idea of reading all of Part Two with its proto-Ulysses like character, there is a version translated by Walter Kaufmann, who's probably more famous to you as the translator, controversial translator of Nietzsche, a version of it that Kaufmann translates, and it's well done because he preserves Goethe's like meter and rhyme. Because there's a lot of like prose translations that are kind of inadequate, or blank verse translations that are inadequate. But apparently, I don't really know German at all, but I kind of looked at the German a little, and it's kind of like a kind of high velocity rhyming poem. So Kaufmann preserves that aspect of it. And then his version is all of Part One and kind of like a digest version of Part Two that basically gives you the plot. All the aspects of Part Two that kind of advance the Faust plot and aren't digressions into other things. I mean, one of the things that happens in Part Two is I think Faust has, I think it's his baby with Helen of Troy. It's very bewildering. I'd have to read it again. I've read Part One like three times, but I only read Part Two once. But he has a baby that goes to fight for Greece and dies in Greece and is clearly an analog of Byron. So Goethe worked on Faust so long that Part One, and this is the reason I'm telling you this, Part One inspires Byron to write Manfred, and then Part Two, is written after Byron's death and includes a figure that's a Byron stand-in. So anyway, this is not a lecture on Goethe's Faust, nor do I remember it as clearly as I wish to, but Goethe's Faust is a wonderful thing that you should read, and Byron was inspired by it to write Manfred. Now, he did not read German, as I don't, though he did read Greek and Latin and other modern European languages, unlike Keats, because he did have an aristocratic and a classical education, but he didn't read German. However, his friend Matthew Lewis, more famous as the author of the scandalous, somewhat sod-like gothic novel, The Monk, which is also a very enjoyable and troubling and dirty book, which I do recommend, The Monk, one of the pioneering gothic novels, Matthew Lewis kind of improvised a translation on the spot for Byron, and kind of like I think it was like acting it out for Byron. So he sort of absorbed it that way, and I think he was almost more inspired by the idea of it than reading it. That can often be the way. This is how at least I defend some of my lack of completism or some of my dilettantism to myself, which is that creative influence in creative writing often works better the less you know. Like you hear the idea and you kind of take your own spin on it, or you read some of the book and you're like, ah, but I would do it this way. And you stop reading the book and you write your own. Sometimes influence creatively can work that way. That it's not really about, like, okay, I've made a scholarly study, I've learned the language, I've annotated it, I've consulted the concordance, and now I can. It's not like you're writing a dissertation on the work. It sparked something in you. And sometimes all you need is the spark, you don't need the whole thing. And that's often the way these things work. And I think sometimes influence study as a genre of literary criticism neglects that and is always seeking like exact verbal correspondences or something, whereas that's not really the idea. That's not really how it always works. So anyway, that was a very long digression, a very long way for me to say that Goethe's Faust, one way or the other, was the inspiration for Manfred, and we have a Faust-like figure. We have this intellectual as magician, as trafficking with the powers and principalities, the powers of the air, etc., throughout. But what's interesting, and this is what so attracted Nietzsche to it, was that Manfred does not sort of ever kowtow to them. He never submits to them. He never trades his soul to them. He's this kind of absolute individual throughout. There is none of this Faustian compromise with these powers. And the powers are impressed by him. They're like, oh, you're almost as powerful as us. You're like not even really human, they say to him. And he always refuses to trade with them, to negotiate with them, to give anything to them. He asks them things, he calls them up, but he wants to command them. He has this kind of absolute mastery throughout the poem. And he extends that to human beings too. He doesn't take the final comfort of the priest at the end. He says it's kind of this arch Protestantism, this point where, and I will reintroduce the G word, where Protestantism becomes Gnosticism. I mean, I think strictly Catholic thinkers think Protestantism is already Gnosticism or perhaps already atheism, but Protestants really don't think that. So there is a point where maybe it becomes that, where it becomes, I am wholly an alien on this earth. I am completely alone. I am completely myself. He refuses all mediation, except for one thing, which we'll get to, in which he shared with his creator. But he's a more absolute version of the Faust figure. He's a Faust without compromise, a Faust without trading his soul. Now, what is it that makes the Byronic hero? And where do we see evidence of the Byronic hero? Now, in its influence in popular culture, by the time you get to Emily Brontë's Heathcliff, and then by the time you get all the way to Batman, it's kind of attenuated. And what it becomes is a brooding man who tends to dress in black. It becomes fairly superficial. By the time it becomes a pop culture archetype or a small r romantic archetype, a kind of version of a sex symbol, a kind of addition to the erotic archetypes. So it's this brooding man dressed all in black and And you know, it's Byron was a sex symbol in his time to women. There was, I think, which of the famous romantic female poets, I think Felicia Hemans, kept a lock of his hair in a locket. And so he was a sex symbol, and the Byronic hero is a sex symbol. And I don't think it's a coincidence that he, the Byronic hero, appears in these, capital R, but also small R romantic novels by women, such as Charlotte and Emily Bronte. So he's an erotic figure because he's brooding, he's in solitude, he's closed in upon himself. And I think, to put it in the contemporary idiom, the response, if you are attracted to him erotically, is, well, I can fix him. I can save him. He would open up for me if for nobody else. So that's why it's such an effective erotic archetype. And there's a female version of this too, I think, in some versions of the femme fatale. I can save her. I can fix her. She'll be warm for me. So I think that's that idea of somebody, the turned back is itself erotic. So I think that's part of it. Part of the brooding, the self-enclosure, the eroticism of the non-attachment, the solitude. Again, we have to talk about that famous painting, Caspar David Friedrich, Wander Above a Sea of Fog. That could be an illustration of what actually happens in Manfred. He's always seeking the sublime peak. The Byronic hero seeks this high point. And again, if we just want to think about Batman as a contemporary version, I just fixate on him because I teach, this graphic novel class all the time, so he's my immediate go-to for that kind of thing. Where is Batman always pictured? On top of a building, looking out over the city. So the Byronic hero sort of seeks these lonely heights, these lonely solitudes. He dresses all in black. He's an intellectual. He's sort of associated somehow with the occult, the dark side, the demonic. He needs only himself. He's self-sufficient. He is. I mean, I think I've made the point, right? Are there other? I could, if this were a proper class for undergraduates, I'd have a bullet-pointed list. But I think I've sufficiently evoked it. And he's tragic. He's headed towards some doom. Now, if it's a popular hero in a serial like Batman, that doom will be permanently postponed, but there's still some sense that it's out there. And if it's a hero in a serious novel like Captain Ahab or like Heathcliff, that doom will be realized. This is a tragic hero. And that what are some of the sources of the Byronic hero? Well, one of them we mentioned is Goethe's Faust and the broader Faust legend. There is Milton's Satan, the brooding, tortured anti-hero of Paradise Lost. There is Hamlet, Shakespeare's most famous hero, tragic hero, who is also kind of an anti-hero. And other sort of tragic villains in Shakespeare, like Iago or Edmund from King Lear, Iago from Othello. So there are these antecedents, but Byron kind of makes it, kind of in a way, he commodifies it. He's the one who puts it into a sellable image. And that happens in Manfred more than anywhere else, and that becomes for us a kind of new addition to the lexicon of culture in this crystallized form of the Byronic hero. So Manfred's first speech, he says, "The lamp must be replenished, but even then it will not burn so long as I must watch. My slumbers, if I slumber, are not sleep, but a continuance of enduring thought, which then I can resist not. In my heart there is a vigil, and these eyes but close to look within. And yet I live and bear the aspect and the form of breathing men. But grief should be the instructor of the wise. Sorrow is knowledge. They who know the most must mourn the deepest or the fatal truth. The tree of knowledge is not that of life." So he's lonely, he's alone, he's in sorrow. Again, he's not a very good dramatic character because these eyes but close to look within. The drama is taking place inside. And now, what is sorrow is knowledge. That's classic. That's in the Bible. That's in Ecclesiastes. That's in the one of the plays of the Oresteia by Aeschylus. That's kind of a classic. Comes down to us from Athens and from Jerusalem. But the tree of knowledge is not that of life. Once you put that in the romantic context, in the Goethe context of those who strive can be saved, that takes on a tragic glamour all its own. In a classical worldview, as in a Judeo-Christian worldview, it's a counsel to humility. You will not be saved by knowledge. You will not be helped by knowledge. So you should just put your faith in God or the gods. In the modern period, which is, all about Schlegel's progressive universal poetry and Goethe's All Who Strive Can Be Saved, it becomes something that you'll seek it even to your doom. You will keep seeking it. You will not relent. You will not learn humility, whether in the classical or the Jewish or the Christian versions. You will not learn humility. You will pursue knowledge, unto death, even though you know it's the opposite of life. So that's one feature of the Byronic hero. And if I emphasize that one, it's because I want to associate him with that Shelleyan idea of Prometheus, of the Promethean, of Prometheus as the true god of modernity, beginning in the Romantic period, or being kind of radicalized out of the Enlightenment by the Romantic period. So Manfred says, "Ye mock me, but the power which brought ye here hath made you mine. Slaves, scoff not at my will. The mind, the spirit, the Promethean spark, the lightning of my being is as bright, pervading, and far-darting as your own, and shall not yield to yours, though cooped in clay." And he's saying this to some of the spirits he's conjured up. So he says, I am full of Promethean fire. I am full of the Promethean spark. The thing in me that's deepest in me that makes me who I am is the thing you are. So me, the mortal cooped in clay, am your equal. Am a god, am a demon, am a monster, but in any case, I'm not merely human. So these eyes but close to look within. Everything goes into the interior, and what's inside? The Promethean spark. And this, I think, so I mention the Byronic hero as underlying all these figures of popular culture, from the dashing and dangerous hero of the romance novel to the darker versions of the superhero. And by that, I mean to indicate the full spectrum of popular culture, from that most associated with a female audience to that most associated with a male audience. It becomes this pervasive pop culture figure. But I also want to say, after saying that Byron, unlike Keats or Shelley, didn't have as much influence on the poets, that it underlies aspects of the philosophical tradition. Nietzsche loved Manfred. Nietzsche identified with Manfred. And Nietzsche, he wrote a whole, whatever that was, a meditation, a musical composition. The whole thing's about 15 minutes long that we began with on the theme of Manfred. And in his book, Ecce Homo, which is one of his kind of late mad works, I think. Is it late? I don't know. It's certainly a mad work. It's the one that has the famous chapter titles, Why I Am So Wise, Why I Write Such Good Books, things like that. I sort of strike that tone on Substack myself, so I understand. But it's in there that he pays tribute to Manfred, where he says, and I have a little passage here on my slide, "I must be profoundly related to Byron's Manfred. Of all the dark abysses in this work, I found the counterparts of my own soul. At the age of 13, I was ripe for this book. Words fail me. I have only a look for those who dare to utter the name of Faust in the presence of Manfred. The Germans are incapable of conceiving anything sublime. For proof of this, look at Schumann. Out of anger for this mawkish Saxon, I once deliberately composed a counter-overture to Manfred, of which Hans von Bülow declared he had never seen the like before on paper. So some other German guy wrote a, well, Schumann, I know who Schumann is, actually. I'm not that bad at music, but Schumann wrote a version of Manfred for music, and Nietzsche thought it was not sublime, so he wrote his own. So that was the inspiration for writing that musical composition. But what interests me is don't say Manfred in the same breath as Faust. Now, part of that is Nietzsche's sort of often histrionic or theatrical cosmopolitanism, xenophilia. I am the good European. I hate these German nationalists. I am really a French writer, etc. There was that aspect of Nietzsche, which is the most the part of him that's least amenable. You know, there's always the debate about Nietzsche and the Nazis, and that's what somebody like Walter Kaufmann will come out and say. Well, no, he was completely averse to some kind of German romantic nationalism. He was a cosmopolitan spirit. So part of it's that he's deliberately being iconoclastic toward a German classic. But I think another part of it is that Manfred doesn't compromise, is that Manfred doesn't, isn't, you know, he doesn't fall in love with a bourgeois girl like Margaret. And he isn't interested in scientific knowledge. And he isn't interested in any kind of merely worldly, you know, magic in the low sense of wanting to affect the material world, you know, get some money for yourself or something. Or in Marlowe, Faust has Mephistopheles bring him, you know, oranges from where do oranges grow? From the tropics, things like this. Manfred, there's no taint of vulgarity in Manfred. Manfred is totally uncompromising, and so he is much more clearly the Byronic hero is much more clearly the pattern for Nietzsche's Übermensch, the proto-existentialist idea of the man of the future who, rejecting all prior given values and rejecting the idea that values could be given, creates values for himself. Okay, creates is free insofar as he obeys his self-given law. Manfred is the type and pattern of the Übermensch. And if that's true, then what's further true is that the Byronic hero is the type and pattern of a certain way of conceiving the modern philosopher, the continental philosopher, this heroic, goes from Nietzsche. There's aspects of it in Heidegger, in Sartre, in Camus, and at least in some of the postmodern and Western Marxist thinkers who are, you know, rejecting all pre-given values, creating new values. So if he doesn't have as much of an influence in the poetic tradition as Keats and Shelley do, if he seems to terminate in dark superheroes and men on the cover of romance novels, if he seems to be have kind of been relegated to pop culture, he still underlies a very influential formulation of the intellectual, of the philosopher, of the radical thinker. So this Byronic hero underlies that secular archetype of the Übermensch as thinker, even more so than Goethe's Faust or than Hamlet, though they are sources. So that's one thing. Manfred, the Byronic hero, the Übermensch, that's one thing I want to look at. And that's maybe a new, we've seen hints of this. We saw hints of this particularly in Blake and particularly in Shelley, each of whom extolled Milton's Satan as a hero. And when conservative critics assailed Byron and Shelley, they did so in the terms of their Satanism. So, if you remember all the way back to the Coleridge lecture, I talked about Coleridge and his college friend Southey, Robert Southey, and they were young radicals, and they were going to go start a commune on the banks of the Susquehanna River in Pennsylvania. They were going to come to America and start afresh and start the revolution and, you know, aflame with these Rousseauist ideas. That's in the 1790s when they were in their 20s. By the time Byron and Shelley come along, these guys are old right-wing figures of the establishment, and they write some of the most brutal attacks on Byron Shelley and what they called the Satanic School of Poetry. So, for instance, this isn't on a slide. I'm just going to read from the Norton Anthology. This is an older, I have an older edition, the sixth edition, before they started putting in, like, the poetry of climate change and things and had to, like, reduce their Coleridge and Shelley selections. But that's a little, that's kind of the kind of a side, I should say, for the paywall. But Coleridge, in one of his works, this is called The Statesman's Manual, denounces the satanic hero. He says, in its state of immanence or indwelling in reason and religion, the will appears indifferently as wisdom or as love, two names of the same power, the former more intelligential, the latter more spiritual, the former more frequent in the Old, the latter in the New Testament. But in its utmost abstraction, it feels like he's been writing in a state of utmost abstraction, but in its utmost abstraction and consequent state of reprobation, the will becomes satanic pride and rebellious self-idolatry in the relations of the spirit to itself, and remorseless despotism relatively to others, the more hopeless as the more obdurate by its subjugation of sensual impulses, by its superiority to toil and pain and pleasure, in short, by the fearful resolve to find in itself alone the one absolute motive of action under which all other motives from within and from without must be either subordinated or crushed. This is the character which Milton has so philosophically as well as sublimely embodied in the Satan of his Paradise Lost. Alas, too often has it been embodied in real life, etc. And he's going to go on actually to connect it to Napoleon as the major political kind of, and Napoleon himself has been conceived as a kind of Byronic archetype come to life. And Byron kind of ambivalently elegizes Napoleon in Childe Harold's Pilgrimage when Childe Harold visits the Waterloo just a year after the battle. But the point is, notice how Coleridge defines the satanic hero as somebody who, for whom will is all. And what do we associate with Nietzsche? The will to power. That this will to power, and this is latent in a philosophical tradition before Nietzsche, some of which Coleridge saw. There's aspects of this there's Schopenhauer before Nietzsche, but then there's aspects of this in Spinoza, etc. I don't want to talk about philosophy because I don't know anything about it, but my point is, will. Everything comes down to will. Everything is in my own will, and there is no other reality. That, for Coleridge, is the essence of the satanic hero, and we see this in Manfred on its way to becoming the Übermensch in Nietzsche. Southey just denounced the whole of what he regarded as the obscenity of contemporary literature in the Regency period, and he said, and here I have to read from a pirated edition that I got on libgen.is of the Norton Anthology's one-time rival, the Longman Anthology, which is what we used in that 19th century British literature class I referred to in the Wordsworth episode, where she began by talking about the romantic ideology. But I was able to get a pirated PDF of this, and they have an excerpt in their Byron section of Southey's denunciation. And Southey says, "The publication of a lascivious book is one of the worst offenses that can be committed against the well-being of society. It is a sin to the consequences of which no limits can be assigned, and those consequences no after repentance in the writer can counteract. Whatever remorse of conscience he may feel when his hour comes, and come it must, will be of no avail. The poignancy of a deathbed repentance cannot cancel one copy of the thousands which are sent abroad, and as long as it continues to be read, so long as he is the pander of posterity, and so long as he heaping up guilt upon his soul in perpetual accumulation." And then he goes on, etc., etc. The school which they have set up may properly be called the Satanic School, for though their productions breathe the spirit of Belial and their lascivious parts, and the spirit of Moloch and those loathsome images of atrocities and horrors which they delight to represent, they are more especially characterized by a satanic spirit of pride and audacious impiety, which still betrays the wretched feeling of hopelessness wherewith it is allied. This evil is political as well as moral, for indeed moral and political evils are inseparably connected. Let rulers of the state look to this in time. And Southey was the poet laureate when he's calling for the censorship of these books, and indeed seems to be calling almost, it sounds to me like, for the execution of the author. So no more young radicalism for Coleridge and Southey. They have become full-on conservatives in their middle and old age, denouncing the satanic school of Byron and Shelley. And you'll note this is a version of the all art is political argument, which we dismissed in our Keats lecture last week. And so this comes from the left and from the right. And I wonder if they were, I wonder if Coleridge and Southey were totalitarian thinkers when they were on the left as well. That wouldn't be unknown. So in any case, this is the denunciation this Byronic hero will receive, which is not to say that there's no critique we can make of this way of thinking, this Byronic Nietzschean way of thinking. I would say, though, that it's not as antisocial as it seems in Blake and in Shelley, though it may appear so in certain ways in Byron or in Nietzsche. And in any case, it will get a much more sophisticated and much more subtle and much more persuasive conservative critique in something like the works of Jane Austen, to which we'll turn next week. But I just wanted to point all that out. So that's my disquisition on the Byronic hero and the Übermensch. I want to look now, I don't want to dwell on this, but I do, you know, hear from people who want me to keep up certain threads. So people often wonder about Gnosticism because I introduced it in the Blake lecture. I think I neglected it last week, but I'll just say quickly, I don't remember what I said last week, but Keats, not a Gnostic, wouldn't call Keats a Gnostic because he's interested in finding the redemption in this world. He sees that as a possibility, hence the sensuality of his art. With Byron's Manfred, though perhaps not in his some of his other more sensuous, indeed sexual work, I think the Gnosticism and the idealism in both its strict philosophical sense and its colloquial sense come out. So Manfred says, from my youth upwards, my spirit walked not with the souls of men, nor looked upon the earth with human eyes. The thirst of their ambition was not mine. The aim of their existence was not mine. My joys, my griefs, my passions, and my powers made me a stranger. Though I wore the form, I had no sympathy with breathing flesh, nor midst the creatures of clay that girded me was there but one who, but of her anon. I said, with men, and with the thoughts of men, I held but slight communion. But instead my joy was in the wilderness, to breathe the difficult air of the iced mountain's top, where the birds dare not build, nor insects' wing flit over the herbless granite, or to plunge into the torrent and to roll along on the swift whirl of the new-breaking wave of river stream or ocean in their flow. In these my early strength exalted, or to follow through the night the moving moon, the stars and their development, or catch the dazzling lightnings till my eyes grew dim, or to look, listening, on the scattered leaves while autumn winds were at their evening song. So that is kind of almost an anthology of motifs that we have seen in Wordsworth, Shelley, Keats. The idea of seeking the sublime scenery of nature to prove the superiority of the mind to it, of being cast out This is more Coleridge in the Rime of the Ancient Mariner, of being cast out from men, of having no human kin, of being a prophet crying in the wilderness, as in Blake, being just a stranger, an alien in this world, seeing only in nature, and not just any nature, but sublime nature or dark nature. Like Keats, he treasures the autumn rather than the autumn decay, the autumn death, the autumn decadence, rather than the renewal of spring, which it's been more common for poets to sing. So this is romanticism as this Gnostic sense of the soul as completely alienated in this world considered as a kind of prison. And the only good place to be in this world is as high up as you can get in it, above even the birds and the insects, higher than things can fly. So there is our romantic Gnosticism and idealism in its philosophical sense, that Kantian sense of the mind and the imagination being that which creates reality. There's also idealism in its colloquial sense of being a person of high ideals, including political ideals. In Manfred, we see what we don't see in Shelley till the very end, till his last unfinished poem, The Triumph of Life, which is a turning away. In Manfred, not in Byron, because Byron does keep up his political ideals and in fact dies for them, but in Manfred, he turns away. He says, I had noble aspirations in my youth to make my own mind the mind of other men, the enlightener of nations. But he goes on and says, I'll summarize somewhat vulgarly. He says, people are actually too stupid for that. I realized the masses were dumb and would never listen to me, and there's not going to be a revolution, and there's not going to be this progress. So I turned away. And then, just as Shelley seems to do, in his elegy for Keats' Adonais, Byron, in the figure of Manfred, seems to predict his own early death. There seemed to be something about the kind of personae, the archetypes these men were trying to be, that death, early death, was built into it from the start. Manfred says, "Look on me. There is an order of mortals on the earth who do become old in their youth and die ere middle age without the violence of warlike death." And so he, ironically, Byron would seek warlike death. But so vivid a prophecy, or, as we'd say, a manifestation, was this that he couldn't even succeed in that. He died without the violence of warlike death, even in the pursuit of warlike death. So those are some more of the themes of Gnosticism and idealism kind of summed up in Manfred. And then the final thing I want to look at is I want to revisit our sexual and gender inquiry that we've been making over these weeks. We saw in almost all the poets, maybe with the exception of Blake, but even in Blake's theory, if not so much in his life, it's there. Which is some notion of androgyny, of the poet as the male poet as a somehow passive figure or a feminized figure or as attracted to a feminine image or something like that. And we've been using Camille Paglia's sexual persona as kind of a guide. I've been skeptical of it every time I brought it up in certain ways, but also as a guide to this. She kind of has an alert eye for these tropes and images. And in Shelley, that was connected to incest. Shelley said that incest was one of the most poetic of circumstances, and he writes a poem to Emilia Viviani called Epipsychidion that we looked at a little bit, where even though he's not related to her, he nevertheless addresses her as his sister and seems to want to fuse with her as part of his Platonism, to become, as Paglia says, hermaphroditic. And similarly, we saw Wordsworth having this spiritual communion with his sister that rendered him, in Paglia's eyes, a psychic transsexual. And in Coleridge, And in Shelley, there's that image of the poet as aeolian harp, a vessel for the overmastering force of nature, which I somewhat, perhaps provocatively, said was the poet's invagination. And Keats wants to become, so Pollya argues, the great mother as part of his Shakespearean sympathy with all things. So this comes up again in Manfred. It comes up in the whole underlying drama of this non-dramatic poem, which is his incest. He has committed incest with his sister Astarte, and then she died. And Astarte is the Babylonian name for Aphrodite, for Venus, so the goddess of love. But what interests me is not just the hint that he committed incest, as Byron also did, but also the way he describes his attraction to her. She was like me in lineaments, her eyes, her hair, her features, all to the very tone, even of her voice, they said were like to mine, but softened all and tempered into beauty. She had the same lone thoughts and wanderings, the quest of hidden knowledge, and a mind to comprehend the universe, nor these alone, but with them gentler powers than mine. So she is the feminine, feminized version of him. So this is what he seeks to have this communion with, both her body and face, which is mirroring his, but feminized. So we have that transgender topos again, the idea that the romantic hero, the romantic poet, somehow is attracted to himself as a woman, but also that they, that platonic, and Byron was not interested in philosophy, he says so in his letters, and I don't know how much of it even read, but there's that Platonism again, that idea going back to Plato's Symposium that we all began as one soul and then divided into two, and so we're all seeking our other half. And that would be, in a way, not only our, if we found that other half, that would be our lover, but also be our sibling. And so we would be reunited with our kind of lost twin. So that romantic incest theme again. And Pollya's take on this is interesting because she says that precisely because he's not a Platonist, because Byron is a genuine sensualist. I think I read that he slept with 200 women. Did I read that? Or did I make that up? And then I didn't read how many men he slept with, but he slept with the men too. So Byron, unlike Shelley, who seemed... I mean, Shelley seemed biographically interested in sex, but not literarily. And there's something, I think Virginia Woolf said, sexless about Shelley. Maybe not in his life, but in his persona. But Byron was not that. And in other works, he's not that. So because, for Pollya, because he is interested in sex, because it's not just an intellectual idea of finding the other half of your soul, but it's literally about fucking your sister, for Byron... She says this is what makes him different from the other romantics. So she says, Lord Byron makes romantic incest stunningly explicit. I see Manfred as a cross-fertilization of Goethe's Faust with Wordsworth's Tintern Abbey. Byron's passionate hero is tormented by guilt for some mysterious crime. He is obsessed with his dead sister, Astarte, his twin in eyes, face, and voice. Byron relishes sexual criminality. Forbidden love makes his characters superhuman. Rejecting all social relationships, Manfred seeks only himself in sexually transmuted form. Wordsworth's sister allows him to remain alone, sex-free. But Astarte, Phoenician Venus, lures Manfred into the vertigo of sex. So it's kind of reverse from Wordsworth, where Wordsworth, the very fact that it was his sister, in a way meant that it would stay mental, that it wouldn't be sex. That loving your sister in Wordsworth, and I think this is true to an extent in Shelley, sort of platonically spares you sex. It's a platonic relationship. So that's part of the attraction to the idea of its being your sister, that sex is taken out of the equation. And of course, many of the Gnostic sects, like the Cathars, abjured sex, refused sex, because sex just perpetuates the human race. It just repopulates the prison of the flesh. So one of the attractions of incest is if you have a spiritual incest but keep the taboo on physical incest, it's purely platonic. But Byron, it's kind of funny, he's like kind of blundering through this idea and not really getting the philosophical nuances, like, I'm going to have sex with my sister, Manfred slash Byron. And so that is, and so sex becomes the kind of wound that is, you know, animates this poem and leads him to his death. And that has a lot to do with the development of sexual archetypes. And this will, I'll fully explain this when we get to Oscar Wilde, but one of the things about Byron is, though you can read a certain appealing androgyny into his image, into the, even the paintings I showed you of him, and there's a certain woundedness and vulnerability that is plausibly feminizing that is still makes him a draw to women in the I can fix him mode. And I didn't even mention he had a deformed foot that was a very, very much a psychic wound to him, that he felt this injury sort of marked and marred him. So, nevertheless, he was a kind of swaggering aristocratic sex symbol, having sex with everybody, including men and women. And so that, Byron becomes one tributary feeding in, because he did have sex with men, to our idea of the homosexual. But then so also did the more Shelley Keats archetype of the, like, spiritually hyper-heterosexual men who only identify with women and are on the verge of being women and are passive lyric poets and perishing Adonises. That also feeds into Wilde's persona. And so the thing is that in Wilde, Wilde's persona is like Byron and Keats as one person, even though these are kind of conflictual archetypes. And then confusingly, that becomes the paradigm of the homosexual when that idea is fully codified and that identity is fully codified. And that's why, you know, when this very day, some bewildered legacy media establishment reporter is going to talk to some young right-wing white boys, and this female reporter is going to be bewildered. This actually happened. I'm not just having a fantasy. This was an article in The Atlantic. The boys told her, well, it's gay to have a girlfriend. And she was like, what sense does that? It's gay to have a girlfriend. Well, that's because the whole idea of gay is this cross-purposed fusion of Keats with Byron. And so it's gay to have a girlfriend because you're acting like Keats, you know. So I'll develop this more, and I'll even go into more explicit contemporary and personal detail about it when we get to Wilde. But I just want to flag that, because Byron as the most sexual persona we're encountering is going to fuse with some of these more platonic, you know, boys of his generation into a single image that's going to prove problematic for our ideas about gender and sexuality. And that, you know, part of the controversies about gender and sexuality in our time is, I think, actually trying to tease some of these strands apart, which is maybe a sensible thing to do, that we all, I think everybody has some criticisms of how it's going, but the motive is perhaps to sort of pull some of these strands that got tangled up apart. So that's my last remark on that. So one of the poem that really, it's very different from Manfred, is Byron's epic, unfinished epic, Don Juan. And it is in this epic poem that you get Byron as a very different, he's still Byronic, but he's witty. He's a man of the world. He is a swaggering, traveling, cosmopolitan aristocrat, and he writes like one. And he writes with an arch wit that you do associate more with Augustan poets like Pope, or with, French culture vis-a-vis English, which are kind of mutually defined against each other. And so this is the funny Byron, the swaggering Byron, the celebrity Byron, the Byron who was called, I think, by Lady Caroline Lamb, one of his mistresses, famously mad, bad, and dangerous to know. And Don Juan also participates in this, revaluation of sexual archetypes, because it's obviously it's based on the Don Juan legend. But what Byron does, notably, is he turns his Don Juan character into a passive figure who's always being sought after and pursued by women who are more sexually aggressive than he is, and who are taking the initiative with him. And at least in what I read, which was most of the first two books, which deal with his first sexual experiences when he's a teenager. And Byron has poignant asides on the plight of women, that they're sort of locked up in these marriages and their sexual appetites go unappeased because often the marriage is merely an economic transaction. And so they have to find love and sex outside of that. And so he does have this sympathetic awareness. He's not just some swaggering Lothario that doesn't understand what's going on, as Shelley sometimes seemed, actually. He seems to have a much more grounded sense of social reality and how it plays into sex than Shelley, who is kind of living his ideals to the detriment of the women he was living with, at least as far as I can tell from what I read of Don Juan. So there's that aspect of it, but I have not read enough of it to fully, comment on that aspect of it. So that's all I'm going to say about that. I want to turn to more strictly literary matters and say that within Don Juan, I think it's toward the end of book one, he writes a little manifesto, like all the people we've been looking at sort of snuck one in somewhere. Either they wrote one explicitly, like Wordsworth and Coleridge and Blake in The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, and Shelley in The Defense of Poetry, or in Keats, he didn't kind of live long enough to write one, but he kind of pieces one through his letters. Well, Byron has one in the asides of his poetic narrator, who's clearly autobiographical, in Don Juan. And I want to look at that and then start to think about the status of the epic poem and what it becomes, as we're going to go on into the novel in this course in the Invisible College. So he says, I have four stanzas here that aren't quite two, they're a pair, they're two pairs. So he says, my poem's epic and is meant to be divided in 12 books, each book containing, with love and war, a heavy gale at sea, a list of ships and captains and kings reigning, new characters, the episodes are three, a panorama view of hells in training after the style of Virgil and Homer, so that my name of epics, no misnomer. All these things will be specified in time with strict regard to Aristotle's rules, the vade mecum of the true sublime, which makes so many poets and some fools. Prose poets like blank verse. I'm fond of rhyme. Good workmen never quarrel with their tools. I've got new mythological machinery and very handsome supernatural scenery. So, a couple of things to note there. He's very meta and self-aware about writing an epic. And he says, I'm going to do it to the rules, but even in saying that, it becomes a kind of comic violation of the rules. It's a kind of violation of epic decorum. And there's even one of the cantos begins, Sing, Muse, etc. Literally, sing, muse, etc. Like, I have this genre that I've selected, and I'm going to hew to its conventions. But I know they are conventions which is to say arbitrary. They're rules outlined by Aristotle. And I'm going to do it in a spirit of fun and of self, romantic irony, the reflection of the artist on his own work to show its constructedness and arbitrariness. So he's writing an epic, but it's a mock epic. He's not taking the epic seriously. And that the mock epic was a very much an Enlightenment Augustan form with Poe's Rape of the Lock, or you could argue that Swift's Gulliver's Travels is a kind of mock epic in prose. So the mock epic, rather than the epic, is what he's able to manage. And then I want to think about his views of his romantic contemporaries. He says, "If ever I should condescend to prose, I'll write poetical commandments which shall supersede beyond all doubt all those that went before. In these I shall enrich my text with many things that no one knows, and carry precept to the highest pitch. I'll call the work Longinus or a bottle, or every poet his own Aristotle. Thou shalt believe in Milton, Dryden, Pope. Thou shalt not set up Wordsworth, Coleridge, Southey, because the first is crazed beyond all hope, the second drunk, the third so quaint and mouthy." I'll just stop it there because he's going to go on to talk about people we don't know about. But notice this. He's making fun of the vogue for writing your manifesto. He says, well, someday maybe I'll condescend to prose and write poetical commandments the way Wordsworth and Coleridge do. But for now, I'll write some here. And he says, every poet his own Aristotle, which is to say, I'm not going to pay attention to rules that are pre-given. And if I do, so he says, I will use rhyme. You know, prose poets like blank verse. I'm fond of rhyme. So he's saying blank verse isn't verse at all. You know, proper poetry rhymes, even though we know from Manfred that he can write very good blank verse. He says, if I use the tools like rhyme and like the structure of epic, I will do it self-consciously, humorously. I'm going to have fun with it, and I'm going to be my own Aristotle. I'm going to give rules to myself, which is, in a comic register, very much like Manfred's willfulness. So what does it look like when the epic no longer has rules and is kind of a leap in the dark? Well, one thing I would argue that looks like is either the lyric or the novel. So we'll come to that. But that this is one of the reasons even his epic is anti-epic. And then the other thing I would note is his hostility to the other romantic poets. Thou shalt believe in Milton. They believed in Milton. Dryden, Pope. Their whole thing was not writing like Dryden and Pope, not writing witty, epigrammatical, rhyming, rhetorical, public, humorous, sexual, sensual poetry. That was the whole thing these guys were against. And he says, thou shalt not set up Wordsworth, Coleridge, Southey. Why? Well, Wordsworth is crazed beyond all hope. And he says in some of the letters I was looking at, he says, you know, Wordsworth is he's metaphysical. All the things that you might say in praise of Wordsworth, he's visionary. Byron's like, what is this shit? There's nothing here. There's no material here. Coleridge, he takes a very cheap shot at Coleridge. Coleridge is a drunk, so I'm not going to listen to him. And see, he calls Southey Southey because he's quaint and mouthy, which is why I read you Southey's denunciation of Byron earlier. You know, he's just this old man with these conservative values railing against the kids and against contemporary culture. So forget the romantic poets forget that first generation, Wordsworth, Coleridge, Southey. I, Byron, am going to go back to Dryden and Pope. I'm going to go back to that Enlightenment model. But if he looks back to the Enlightenment model, his freedom with his materials, his inability to truly write an epic that conforms to the rules, nonetheless participates in what a writer like Wordsworth is also participating in, which is making the epic personal, making it a lyric. And insofar as his epic is about characters and he's interested in their psychologies and he kind of embeds them in dense social situations, which he does, he's also turning the epic into the lyric or into the novel. So he's participating in turning the epic into the novel and into the lyric. And if we take the Byronic hero, who will become an archetype in pop culture, that's the third thing the epic becomes. The sort of mytho-poetic part of the epic becomes pop culture and popular fiction and its hero. So I have, this is my final slide, my explanation as we begin to read the novel for next week of why Romanticism couldn't produce an epic. Because I think what we're looking at is the modern decomposition of the epic into three tributary modes. So if we accept the idea that the epic poem, and this maybe we shouldn't accept this, maybe this itself is an artifact of German Romanticism. I think Schlegel and Schiller talk about this, and then it passes in from the German Romantics, it passes into Marxist critics. So Georg Lukács and Mikhail Bakhtin talk about this in the 20th century. But if we accept for a moment one definition of an epic, which is that it is a poem that expresses the values of a whole society, whether that be the Greek society that Homer writes about or, sings of in the Iliad and the Odyssey, or whether that be Virgil trying to write a national epic, an imperial epic, talking about the founding of Rome and of the Roman Empire, or of Dante and Milton, who in their different ways are trying to sum up the whole of Christianity as they understand it, also with some national spirit, particularly Dante writing in the vernacular rather than Latin. And Milton had wanted to write a national epic, but he despaired of England after the Restoration, and so he wrote a Christian epic. But in any case, the way I've couched this, because we live in a very pronoun conscious age, I've couched it as a matter of pronouns. The pronoun of the epic is we. Even though we have a poet who speaks in his own voice and invokes the muse, what the muse nevertheless discloses is a collective vision. We are the hero of the epic. Whether we are the Achaeans, the Greeks, whether we are the Roman Empire, whether we are the community of Christian believers or the community of Italian speakers, the epic of Homer, of Virgil, of Dante, and of Milton is for us. It is we who are its ultimate heroes. But the reason you can't write a real epic that everybody can agree on after the 17th century in which Milton is writing is because, as a number of social thinkers have posited, what the process of modernity is a differentiation and individualization of life. So the epic poet is sort of almost like a shamanic figure. He is a seer. He is a poet, but not just as an entertainer. There's a way in which he's also a priest, a visionary, a healer, a leader. But all these functions get separated out in modernity. The shaman becomes the priest on the one hand, the doctor on the other, the scientist on the other, the poet on the other, the lawyer on the other. This thing that had one function in a more integral and what was seen as a more organic, archaic society, modernity separates out and specializes. And so the poet or the creative writer becomes a very distinct archetype away from the human community. That's why there's all these images of alienation and loneliness. The outcast poet becomes an outcast in romanticism, Polly, you know, in sexual personae, kind of jeers. She says there are these, like, how does she put it? There are these, like, I'm being cruder than she is, but there are these girly men, you know, who resent these virile men who actually run things. So the poet becomes a much more delimited role. And the whole drive of modern society is toward more and more individualism. Every poet his own Aristotle. Every person their own Aristotle. Until we're completely atomized. And in this increasingly atomistic society, you can't write an epic anymore. You can't pursue this kind of integral literary form anymore because there's no integral society on which it could be modeled or for it to address. So the we of the epic, in my view, decomposes into three singular pronouns. And I've already kind of gone through this, I just want to make it clear. First is the I of the lyric poem and its reflection on the consciousness of the poet and the language of the poet that we saw in Wordsworth and Coleridge's conversation poems, that we saw in Shelley and Keats's odes, that we are going to see in Walt Whitman or Gerard Manley Hopkins or Yeats or Wallace Stevens. And there is, this it does exist in the epic, because in the epic, so every one of these pronouns exists in the we of the epic. The I of the lyric exists in the epic poet's invocation to the muse and asides on his vocation, which we find plentifully in Dante and Milton. So there is that, there's a lyric strain in the epic that becomes the lyric poem proper, and that is why perhaps the most achieved of all romantic epics, which is Wordsworth's Prelude, is simply a 300-page lyric poem. It's Tintern Abbey at book length. So the we of the epic first becomes the I of the lyric. I would say in Byron, with his sympathetic attention to his female characters embedded in a more realistic social setting, the epic also becomes the she of the realist novel, with its focus on domestic space, its focus on inner life, its focus on the self in relation to society. And whether it's written by a man or a woman, the bourgeois novel tends to be focused, not exclusively, but we often think of it in terms of women, whether it's Pamela and Clarissa in Richardson, or the many heroines of Jane Austen, such as Elizabeth Bennet or Emma Woodhouse, or Emma Bovary, or Hester Prynne, or Anna Karenina, or Mrs. Ramsay and Mrs. Dalloway, or Molly Bloom, or Ursula and Gudrun Brangwyn, or the Schlegel sisters in Howard's End, the she of the high art tradition of the novel, the bourgeois realist domestic novel. And there is a strain in the epic that that's picking up on. There is the some of the most beautiful moments in the Iliad are the portrayals of the kind of home front at Troy, of Hector and Andromache, or of the Ithaca sections of the Odyssey focused on Telemachus and Penelope, the exaltation of Beatrice in Dante, the loving portrait of Eve in Milton, who is otherwise a misogynist, but nevertheless captures something loving in his portrayal of Eve. So the realist novel, the we of the epic, becomes the she of the realist novel in ways anticipated perhaps by Byron's Don Juan. And then finally, the fantastical portion of the epic, the mythopoeic, or however you pronounce that, portion of the epic, the myth-making part of the epic, the supernatural, the gods and monsters and angels and demons, that goes into pop culture and pop narrative. That becomes the he of these heroes of popular culture and narrative, whether it's in the Byronic hero like Manfred, which then goes into popular culture in pop fiction, starting with Mary Shelley and Poe, and into Stevenson, and into Stoker, and into then the pulps, and then into the superheroes, and into Superman and Batman. So the gods and heroes and monsters of Homer and Virgil and Dante and Milton become these modern popular commodities of the modern myths of Frankenstein's monster and of Dracula and of Batman and of Superman. So the we of the epic becomes the I of the lyric, the she of the realist novel, and the he of the pop culture heroes and anti-heroes. And that's why the Romantics couldn't write an epic, why we don't have epics, really, properly. Because it's all been differentiated through the ongoing atomization of modernity, and even genius-level poets who wanted to write an epic weren't able to do so. And I think Byron, you know, being the last figure we look at, his work kind of encapsulates that in his first of all, his creation of the Byronic hero, which becomes that he of popular culture, and then his more novelistic approach to the epic, which becomes that she of the realist novel. And speaking of she in the realist novel, we have been reading all of these men and all of these visionary poets, even though most of them didn't quite seem happy or able to be men. Nevertheless, we've been reading all of this. And so now, next week, we are going to turn to the novel. The novel, perhaps the most popular novel of Jane Austen, Pride and Prejudice, which belongs and doesn't belong to the Romantic era, as we'll see. In the meantime, I thank you for your attention. I hope those of you that are listening to this for free, which is everyone listening to this, will consider a paid subscription. This is just a small sample of what I'm able to offer on the paywalled episodes. I hope you will consider a paid subscription, and I hope you will join us for future episodes of The Invisible College. Thanks so much for your time and attention. I have been and remain your host, John Pistelli. You can consult the PDF version of the slideshow corresponding to this lecture at grandhotelabyss.substack.com, the same place you can offer a paid subscription. Thank you for your time, and I'll see everybody next week. Thanks a lot.